The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're looking at what science has to say about the origins of selfless behavior. A little later on, we'll talk to Duke University neuroscientist Steve Chang. His research in monkeys might give us clues about what happens in the brain when we're being helpful. But first, let's take a historical look at how scientists have factored altruism into evolution and natural selection. I'm here with Lee Dukotkin. Lee is a professor and distinguished university scholar in the Department of Biology at the University of Louisville. His main area of research interest is the evolution of social behavior, and he's written a number of textbooks and books for a lay audience. He's here to talk about the altruism equation. Seven scientists search for the origin of goodness. Lovely to have you back, sir.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So the issue of altruism is usually thought of as a philosophical idea, and the arguments about it are often philosophical in nature. But according to your book, scientists have had just as many arguments about it?
Certainly. But I wouldn't say they're completely independent of the philosophical side.
Right.
Initially, folks that we would look back on now and think of as scientists really pondered the evolution of altruism from what one might say is somewhat of a philosophical perspective. And then over time, the argument itself became more based on empirical results and mathematical models. So there's been a development within science itself. It's still got philosophical underpinnings and always will. I mean, you talk about something like the evolution of altruism, and you're talking about goodness, you're talking about cooperation, you're talking about all the things that people care about. And so there are always going to be some philosophical connections. But we try and study it the way that we would study any trait in evolution and behavior.
Speaking of evolution, this goes all the way back to Darwin. He was concerned about a particular kind of altruism, sterile castes of social insects.
Right. He was concerned about it to the extent that he would write in letters that this was a problem that was driving him half mad, that he really feared that that the question of how altruism evolves could be one that might, in fact, sink his entire theory. And as you say, Darwin was worried about it in a couple of different ways, but the key one was these sterile castes in social insects. And the problem is, like everybody knows, if you get too close to, for example, a honeybee nest or the nests of many different ant, bees, or wasps, you'll get attacked by workers that are defending the hive. And it turns out that in some species, defenders do such a good job that they keep potential predators away, but only at the cost of their own lives. So in some species, when you get stung, the stinger basically rips away from the body of the insect, and it stays in you and keeps pumping nasty stuff into you. But the worker who did that is in fact now dead. And this was a real problem. I mean, Darwin thought that essentially what he was seeing was, in many ways, you know, exactly what you shouldn't see if selection operated the way that he described it. So if you classically think of individuals who have traits that in some way allow them to get more resources and out reproduce other individuals, then the traits that they have should increase over time. And here you have a group of insects, the workers, that in fact defend the hive with their own lives. Now, it's really sort of interesting because the workers themselves, for the most part, don't reproduce. And so what they're really doing is they're protecting the queen, who is a little baby-producing factory. And for Darwin, there were a couple of things about the social insects that made them interesting. One was the mere presence of individuals who, in fact, don't reproduce. And the second was that these individuals, in fact, often risk their own lives to protect others in their hive. Now, I should say we've also learned since Darwin's day that that workers who defend the hive are capable in some circumstances of reproducing on their own, and they try to do that when they can. The queen often does goes to all sorts of lengths to prevent that and to destroy any eggs that workers produce, but it happens occasionally. So this was something that really bothered Darwin. He thought, well, how can you have non-reproductive individuals, and how can you have those individuals going around risking their lives to save everybody else?
Well, now, did he think that this might destroy his entire theory? Was it that potentially damaging?
Yeah, I mean, he uses that language in The Origin of Species, and he uses it in a way that's very, very strong. I mean, he basically says that he feared that if he could not come up with an explanation for this, that people would dismiss his entire theory. And that's very, very strong for Darwin. You don't see him write that sort of thing very often. He was excellent and very conscientious about writing about the problems that he saw with his own theory. But rarely do you see him say things like the problem was potentially so devastating that it might sink the whole theory. And to make the problem worse, in Darwin's eyes, it wasn't just an evolutionary riddle. It was an evolutionary riddle that people would know about and care about. So, for example, if the problem had been something else for Darwin, the odds are that most people wouldn't have known about some subtle issue in animal behavior and evolution. But, of course, everybody understands what happens when you get too close to the nest or hive of a social insect. And, in fact, at that time, there was really a social insect craze, particularly a honeybee craze that was going around Victorian England, because they had recently learned that one way that the individual chosen to be the queen is chosen is that they're fed this wonderful substance called royal jelly. And the individuals who were fed this are more likely to become queens. And the Brits just sort of discovered that, and there was this amazing fascination with honeybees. And so Darwin knew that there was no way that this problem was going to, was going to sneak under the radar. It was going to be something that people immediately recognized.
So what did Darwin then think was the root of all this, of the altruism, as it were?
So you have to remember that when The Origin of Species came out in 1859, Darwin didn't know about Mendel's ideas on genes, because Mendel was just doing that work, and it was just getting published right about the same time. And it wasn't really, it didn't get rediscovered until 1900. Most people never heard of Mendel's ideas until about 1900. So what's important about that is that there was no language of genetics at the time. And so Darwin didn't go around talking about genes for this or genes for that, but he understood that there was something that individuals were passing down to their offspring that made offspring look like and act like their parents, right? He understood there was something that today we would call genetic material. He sometimes referred to these things as gemmules. He understood that there was something like that. And so eventually, from some very strange sources, he began to put together an argument, which was that if you look at who it is that these workers are defending, it's not just any old group of bees or ants or wasps in the area. It's their hive. And even though there was no language of genetics per se at that time, Darwin and Victorian naturalists understood that hives were just stock full of relatives. Today, what we would call genetic relatives, but they were relatives, and the Brits understood that very well. And Darwin pieced together an argument that went like this. If you, as a worker, potentially even give up your own life to defend the hive, but at the same time, by doing that, you somehow increase the probability of lots and lots of your genetic relatives surviving, then on the kind of spreadsheet of natural selection, where you're looking at costs and benefits, it could be that more copies of what today we would call a gene get into the next generation, even when workers give up their own lives, because essentially they're protecting this gigantic baby-producing factory called the queen, and who pumps out tons of the workers' genetic relatives. And so that may make up for the worker giving up their own life and more. And then you have a much more kind of classic evolutionary explanation. You basically have more copies of the gene getting into the next generation, even though the individual expressing a trait dies in doing it. And that's an extreme case. You don't certainly have to have individuals dying in order to express altruism. That's the most extreme version of altruism. But even that could be explained by this helping your relatives.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Lee Dukotkin, author of The Altruism Equation. Now, at that point, it's an educated opinion, but it's still just Darwin's opinion. So, of course, people took sides, and one side was taken by Thomas Henry Huxley, and the other was taken by Peter Kropotkin. So maybe let's start with some background on those guys.
Right. So Darwin writes about this in 1859, and the altruism question really doesn't rear its head in a big way until about 25 to 30 years later, when these two characters that you're talking about, Thomas Henry Huxley and Peter Kropotkin, come onto the stage. And I use the word character there intentionally. They were both regarded as two of the leading scientists in the world, but their lives were really the kind of stuff of movies. So let me give you a little background on where they come down on this issue. Huxley was probably the most famous scientist in England at the time. He was Darwin's good friend. And basically, Darwin didn't have the personality type, and he was often too ill to go out and be the one to stand up and present his ideas to the public and even to the to fellow scientists. Huxley was the guy who did that for Darwin, and he loved it. He gave himself the nickname Darwin's Bulldog, and he was the face of evolutionary biology early on. Well, Huxley weighs in on this question of altruism in a big way very soon after, in fact, Darwin dies in the, I think it was in 1888 that Huxley weighed in on this, and Darwin died very, very close to that, maybe a year or so before, I don't remember exactly, but Huxley wrote what amounted to an obituary in a very famous magazine at the time called 19th Century. This was a place where ex-prime ministers wrote their thoughts on politics, and Beatrix Potter would write children's stories. It was kind of the magazine for the intelligentsia. And in there, Huxley writes an article called The Struggle for Existence, a Program. And basically in there, he takes Darwin's arguments and he pushes them about as far as they can be pushed. And so what he basically says in very, very florid and vivid language is that nature is essentially a bloodbath. And he uses gladiator metaphors, and he talks about, you know, the stupidest and the weakest being pushed up against the wall and gotten rid of. But basically, he makes the argument that it's a nasty, nasty world out there. And then he says the one exception to this is the interactions that occur among individuals in the family. And there you see what, you know, today we would refer to as altruism. So Huxley takes the Darwinian position that kinship drives the evolution of altruism, but he pushes it as much further than Darwin did. Darwin simply said, look, here's one idea on what drives the evolution of altruism. And he didn't make pronouncements about how common altruism was or not. He simply said, I think kinship could help us understand this. Huxley extends the argument to say, you very, very rarely see altruism. And when you do, the only time you ever see it is among individuals who are part of the same family. Now, on the other side of what very quickly turned into a vociferous debate is this fellow named Peter Kropotkin, who is one of my all-time favorite people in terms of folks I've had a chance to research. If people listening to the show have heard of Peter Kropotkin, it's likely that they've heard of him in the context of politics, because he was one of the leading anarchists of the day in the late 1800s. But Kropotkin had another side to him, which was that he was also one of the most respected scientists of the day, both in evolutionary biology and in geology. And with an evolutionary biology, when he saw Huxley's article, it infuriated him because Kropotkin had actually spent 5 years studying natural history of humans and animals in Siberia on sort of a much colder version of the Voyage of the Beagle, where when he studied animals and humans in Siberia, he thought that altruism and cooperation were sort of the default condition of what he saw. He saw individuals giving alarm calls. He saw groups huddling together for warmth. Everywhere he looked, he thought he saw altruism. He called it mutual aid, but essentially it's today what we would call altruism. And so in the first place, he thought Huxley was wrong about the frequency of this, that it was actually everywhere. Not a rare thing, but everywhere. The second thing he thought Huxley was wrong about was that in Kropotkin's eyes, he saw no evidence that this was tied to kinship. He seemed to see altruism dispensed to whoever needed it. It wasn't tied to genetic relatedness at all. And so he writes a series of articles in the same magazine that Huxley did, which eventually become a book called Mutual Aid. And the battle lines are essentially drawn by these guys in the late 1880s. I won't get into it too much, but it's very interesting if you read Kropotkin's work, because Kropotkin the anarchist and Kropotkin the evolutionary biologist are actually very, very difficult to disentangle, because part of Kropotkin's philosophy of anarchy came by studying mutual aid and altruism in animals. And basically, when he was watching animal populations in Siberia for those 5 freezing years, when he kept seeing this mutual aid and altruism, he recognized that there was nothing like government in animal societies. And yet, in his eyes, they were always cooperating and being altruistic with one another. And so this notion that if you just let small groups of individuals interact, they will naturally be altruistic to each other, comes from his biological studies. But in fact, it's really at the heart of what the anarchist position is that government is the problem. If you let people just interact with each other without the rules of government, they tend to do nice things to one another. So for Kropotkin, both of those things were one and the same. But now the argument is laid down in extreme forms. Huxley, you very rarely see altruism. It's always tied to kinship. Kropotkin, you see it everywhere, and it's never tied to kinship.
This is thrilling.
Yeah, I haven't even told you about the. I skipped Kropotkin's jailbreak that was covered by the New York Times, but maybe some other time we'll get into that.
If anyone would like to know more about Peter Kropotkin, you can download our very entertaining interview with Lee about his book, The Prince of Evolution. Just go to the episodes page on our website at Skeptically Speaking and look for episode 129. So we have these two sides, but these are both intelligent men. And how could they come to such completely different conclusions?
Oh, right. I mean, they were some of the most intelligent men of the day. And, you know, it's always difficult to say how people come to such different, dramatically different conclusions. There's a really interesting theory that I think is probably close to the mark that was first discussed by a historian of science by the name of Daniel Todes. And what he says is that really what drove these guys to such different positions was both the way that science was done in the societies in which they grew up, meaning England and Russia for England for Huxley and Russia for Kropotkin, the way that science was done there, and also the kind of political atmosphere in those places. So in the case of Huxley, what you have is a Victorian, very, very competitive society. But on the scientific end, what's going on is people like Darwin, but also Huxley, who also went on an incredible adventure as the physician on a ship called the Rattlesnake, where they went down to South America and did some wonderful natural history work himself. But most of the Brits, they were going down to the tropics, either in South America or in the case of Wallace, who's, by the way, it's his 100th anniversary of his birth this year, so there's a big Wallace thing going on. Wallace went out to the South Pacific, but they were all working, in the tropics. And the argument goes that, in the tropics, it may very well be that there's high levels of competition in many species, because you've got densely packed individuals in areas where, because they're densely packed, there you may see lots and lots of competition for resources. Now, and that may have led Huxley to this kind of dog-eat-dog view of evolution and natural selection. On the other hand, you've got Peter Kropotkin, who at the start is still in, for most of his life, is living under czarist rule, but there are the stirrings of socialism and anarchy and communism even during Peter's later life. And so you have a very different political climate that isn't really the kind of competitive world of Victorian science. But again, on the science end, what's different about what Russian evolutionary biologists are doing is they're not studying in the tropics. They're studying in places like Kropotkin studied in Siberia, where it's freezing and densities of animals are very, very low. If anything, underpopulation seems to be a problem in these places, not overpopulation. And so what's going on is that individuals basically have to help each other, and they're essentially cooperating with one another against this hyper nasty environment in which they live. And that is the way that Kropotkin and the early evolutionary biology school in Russia saw the world. Now, one thing that sometimes sort of slips between the cracks is that Kropotkin is a hardcore evolutionary biologist. He's not challenging the notion that evolution by natural selection is what drives diversity and the history of life. He is simply saying that natural selection can just as easily lead to altruism as it can competition. He certainly recognized competition was going on, but he said, look, you know, you can also have natural selection leading to altruism in a very Darwinian view. Later on, he took some views that were slightly less Darwinian, but for most of his life, he was taking a very classic view of the way selection operated. It was just that it could lead to cooperation and altruism, not just competition. So I think it's the combination of the political climates to some extent in which they live, but more so the places that scientists from those two different worlds went were so dramatically different that you really could have these diametrically opposed views of the way that nature operated.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be back with more from Lee Dukotkin, author of The Altruism Equation, after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and my guest today is Lee Dukotkin, professor in the Department of Biology at the University of Louisville and the author of The Altruism Equation, Seven Scientists Search for the Origin of Goodness. So after Huxley and Kropotkin, no one seems to have really made any substantial progress in this area, in the altruism area, until the 1920s. So why was that?
It's a good question. I think, and it really was the 20s and 30s where this idea resurfaced. It's hard to say why people weren't arguing about it the way that Huxley and Kropotkin were. I think part of it is that Huxley and Kropotkin sort of laid out about as much as of the argument as you can lay out without actually doing experiments and developing theory. I mean, they took two very extreme positions, and I think they covered what virtually everyone out there thought was going on. They either agreed with one of them or they agreed with the other one. And then there's a lull because, first of all, Darwinian thinking is still really sort of penetrating into biology and the rest of the sciences, and people are wrestling with exactly how things work. There are all sorts of debates of one sort or another. But, you know, until about the early 1930s, people were not developing research programs where they were trying to understand things like altruism through experiments and through mathematical models. And I think that's, you know, the major reason you have this lull.
There's someone who takes center stage, if we're using your character metaphor, Warder Clyde Allee.
Right. So Werner Clyde Ali is this fascinating character who grew up in the Midwest and was a hardcore Quaker who really shifted the way that people think about primarily ecology. He was a University of Chicago professor who was part of a group that sort of reshaped, really gave birth to the modern field of ecology. But Ali was also interested in some questions of behavior and evolution. And one of the key ones was the evolution of altruism and cooperation. And again, you know, I mean, it really is appropriate to talk of at least the people we've talked about so far as characters, because just like Kropotkin, if you look at Ali's other writings, in Ali's case, they were writings as a Quaker leader of the time and also one of the better-known pacifists in the United States. His writings are just stock full of these images of cooperation, altruism, and pacifism in a political context. But he's also doing what amounts to the first real scientific experiments on cooperation and altruism. And there he's doing things like understanding the way that animals, for example, huddle together for warmth, or in some way or another, help each other in the environment in which they live. So he's looking at everything from aquatic insects to chickens, and he's starting to do the first studies to show that population growth can be sort of more than the sum total of just what each individual does. In other words, you can't just sort of add up what everybody does and come up with what the total for the population is. And the difference is, in fact, due to the cooperative interactions among animals. And so Ali takes a very Kropotkin-like view of this cooperation and altruism, except in his case, it's more based on experiments. And he thinks that cooperation is quite common in animals, and again the link to kinship, although it may be real in some instances, is not the key. For Ali, it was simply that selection favors this regardless of kinship and genetic relatedness. And he writes about this in a whole series of books. He writes in a very famous article in Science called Where Angels Fear to Tread. He lays out this whole program for the way that cooperation and altruism evolve. But he's not really an evolutionary biologist per se. This is just one of his evolutionary interests. There's another fellow who really sort of takes the Huxley-like position, but from the viewpoint of a mathematician who also comes onto the stage in the 1930s. And that's a guy named J.B.S. Haldane, who I can tell you a little bit about if you like.
Please do.
So Haldane was at the time one of the most famous mathematical evolutionary biologists of his day. He and a few others founded an entire field that is known as population genetics. And he came from a really strong lineage of scientists. His father was a scientist for the government, and he was at Haldane himself was at one of the major universities in England. And he is writing these papers that are just impenetrable to the non-mathematician. They're just filled with, you know, literally 50 equations. But Haldane has this interest in the evolution of altruism. And oddly enough, it's sort of the one area that he delves into that he doesn't really go into extremely mathematically. He just basically addresses it the way that a mathematician would if they were having a beer but didn't have a piece of paper and a pencil. And so there's actually a famous, I think it's true, if not, there's a famous story where that Haldane was sitting in a pub one time talking about the evolution of altruism and that kind of thing with some of his blokes, and they start talking, and Haldane essentially tries to put in mathematical terms the kinship component that Darwin had suggested was so important. So Darwin talked about it in general terms, and what Haldane said was that he would jump into a lake and risk his life to save two or more of his siblings or eight or more of his cousins. It actually may have been jump into a river, but he was going to jump into something, and he was going to save two. He would do it for save two or more of his siblings or eight or more of his cousins. So this is a very odd thing to say until you realize that Haldane and others were some of the first to actually calculate the exact genetic relatedness among relatives. And the relatedness between siblings is one half. And the scale of relatedness goes from 0 to 1. So siblings are related by one half to each other, which means essentially that there's a 50% probability that if one sibling has a specific copy of a gene, the other sibling does. Well, it also turns out that cousins are related to each other by a factor of 1/8. Now, if you think about Haldane's comment, I would save two or more of my siblings. Two or more of his siblings essentially amount to one or more genetic copies of himself, because if his siblings are related to him by a half, then saving two or more of them is equivalent to saving more copies of the genes that actually reside in his body. And so evolutionarily, that kind of action should be favored. And the same thing about cousins. They're related by an eighth. So he would jump in and risk his life to save cousins, but only if there were eight or more of them at risk, because eight times an eighth gives you one, which is sort of what Haldane himself or anybody was worth genetically. And more than eight gives you more than one. And so those sorts of behaviors should be favored by natural selection. But he does not set that down in equation form. He sets down virtually every other thought he had in life in equation form, but he does not set that down in equation form. But that's where the argument is in the sort of early 1930s, 1940s. Ali on the empirical side, Haldane on the theoretical side, Haldane saying relatedness is important, Ali saying it's not that important, and you see cooperation and altruism everywhere.
You are the only person who should be allowed to talk about these topics ever.
I don't know about that, but I certainly do like talking about it.
It's way more exciting. You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Lee Dukotkin talking about his book, The Altruism Equation, 7 Scientists Search for the Origin of Goodness. Okay, on to David Hamilton, and we started the math previously, and then it's pretty much all mathy from here on in. So we also take a rather large leap forward in our understanding of kin selection and altruism. So who was Hamilton?
Right, so his name was William David Hamilton, and then he goes, and everybody refers to him as W.D. Hamilton. And, if we look back now, Hamilton died, unfortunately, at a fairly young age, I think in the year 2000. If we look back now, most folks would say he was probably the most important evolutionary biologist of the 20th century, and he made these fundamental contributions, many, many fundamental contributions to our understanding of evolution and behavior. But perhaps his most famous one is the one that deals with this question that we've been talking about, which is the evolution of altruism. So Hamilton was raised in a house that is just a couple of miles from Darwin's Downhouse. And when I had the opportunity to write the altruism equation, I went over to England, and W.D. Hamilton was already gone, but his sister was there, and she allowed me to interview her in the house where she and Bill Hamilton had grown up. And she told me these incredible stories. So their mother was a very, very intelligent person, and so was their dad. And their mom used to read them The Origin of Species as a bedtime story. And she would take them to Darwin's house and talk to them about evolutionary biology. And Bill's sister would show me these places in the backyard and in the closet where Hamilton had done these sort of primitive genetic experiments at the age of 15. So he was just a brilliant kid, and he was interested in the evolution of altruism. And he went to Cambridge, and right away he knew this is what he wanted to study. So he studied, Haldane was one of his idols. He also read some of the other major folks like Haldane, a fellow named Ronald Fisher. And Hamilton was very interested in how altruism evolved. But he sort of got into a bit of trouble very early on in college when he expressed this interest, because he was in the Department of Genetics at Cambridge. And they have to take the equivalent of a minor as well. And he decided that because he was interested in the evolution of altruism, he wanted to take a minor in anthropology because clearly anthropologists are also interested in cooperation and altruism, primarily in humans, but that's great. So he has the geneticist, you know, he has a home department of genetics and a second department of anthropology. Well, he goes over to anthropology and he tells them that he is interested in building a genetic theory for the evolution of altruism. And the anthropologists all but throw him out of the office on the seat of his pants and tell him that nobody is doing eugenics in our department. Nobody is going to study something as important as a behavior like altruism from a genetic perspective. We won't hear of it. We don't even want people talking about that. And Hamilton is very distraught that this is the kind of response he got. So he goes back and he talks to the people in the Department of Genetics, and their response is sort of equally disturbing to Hamilton. And their response was, don't worry about what the people in anthropology do. What they do is about as close to biology as poetry is to biology, and it doesn't really matter what they say. So anyway, he gets a little bit disillusioned with both departments, but he sticks it out and he starts developing more and more ideas on the evolution of altruism. And then he goes to graduate school to really get into this. And oddly enough, he actually does his graduate work somehow, and no one's quite sure exactly how, at two different places. But the main place he did it was the London School of Economics, which seems like a really strange place for someone to do a thesis on the evolution of altruism. But for Hamilton, learning about the way that economists think was really important because evolutionary biology is sort of economics across generations. We all of our models are essentially economic models, except that instead of just considering what happens in very, very short time frames, we build economic models that look at whether or not something's going to work, meaning whether selection will favor it over, you know, many, many generations, perhaps millions of generations. So Hamilton got this great training there in how to think like a mathematician, like a mathematical economist. And then he translated that into evolutionary thinking. And what he does is he really does formalize Darwin's ideas on kinship and Haldane's little stories about kinship. And he comes up with a mathematical model for how when kinship is important and how important it can be in driving the evolution of altruism. And he basically puts this out to the scientific community in two ways. First, he writes this extremely dense set of papers that are published in a journal called the Journal of Theoretical Biology. It's 52 pages that are just stock full of mathematical equations, and they're the most cited pair of papers in the study of evolution and behavior today. And my bet is they're probably also the least read papers in the field because they're just very, very difficult to work through. Fortunately, Hamilton summarized his ideas in a little three-page paper in another journal that boils down all of the mathematics to one simple equation that has just three things that you need to keep track of when you want to know whether or not altruism is going to evolve. And it's that paper that has driven, I think, most of the work on the evolution of altruism. And Hamilton says, all you got to do if you want to understand the evolution of altruism is keep track of three things. You need to know exactly how related individuals are. You need to know how much it costs to help others, and you need to know how much help you get if somebody helps you. And if you can measure all of those things, you can predict when altruism is going to evolve. And it turns out the answer is that altruism can evolve by helping your genetic kin when the indirect kickbacks that you get by helping your kin are greater than the cost of being altruistic. In a sense, this is what Darwin said in 1859, but he didn't show it in mathematical form. Hamilton shows specifically the mathematics that say, take your genetic relatedness to every individual you help, multiply it by how much they're being helped, and that's kind of the indirect kickback that you get. Because if you help your sibling, it's like you're helping yourself, but only half as much as if you really help yourself, because your siblings only have a relatedness of half to you. If you help your cousins, you're also indirectly helping yourself, but not as much, because your genetic relatedness to your cousins is less. So take all of the individuals that you help and multiply how much you help them by your genetic relatedness. And if that number is greater than the cost to you of being altruistic, then altruism evolves. And if it isn't, then altruism doesn't evolve. And this little equation soon began to be called Hamilton's rule for the evolution of altruism. And, you know, we don't have a whiteboard or a blackboard in front of us, so I can't give it to you like in true equation form, but it's genetic relatedness times the benefit to those that are helped has to be greater than the cost of being altruistic. That's Hamilton's rule. That's what one of the core ideas that's behind the modern study of evolution and behavior.
Unfortunately, this equation, although revolutionary, it didn't get much attention, but that all changed with the publication of two of the most popular evolutionary biology books ever written, Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene and E.O. Wilson's Sociobiology. And we'll be back to talk about that after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're taking a look at man's best friend through the lens of current research. We'll talk to Brian Hare, director of the Duke Canine Cognition Center and co-founder of Dognition, about his book, The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. Science writer Virginia Hughes breaks down the genetic history separating dogs from wolves, and author Deborah Blum explains why chocolate is so dangerous for our canine companions. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm talking about the book, The Altruism Equation, Seven Scientists Search for the Origin of Goodness, with author Lee Dukotkin. Before the break, we were talking about how Hamilton's equation didn't really get the attention that it deserved until Richard Dawkins and E.O. Wilson popularized it. So what's the background there?
So Hamilton was a Brit, and by the time that Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, came out in 76, Hamilton certainly had spent plenty of time in England. And in The Selfish Gene, Dawkins basically lays out Hamilton's ideas in the kind of wonderful way that Richard Dawkins can lay out ideas, and argues that that this is going to be once people understand this, they're going to see that this is going to sort of revolutionize the way people think about not just the evolution of altruism, but just the importance of genetic relatedness in driving behavior. And he writes quite a bit about it, and very glowingly. And then E.O. Wilson writes about it in sociobiology, because he discusses altruism as sort of one of the fundamental riddles that has puzzled evolutionary biologists since the time of Darwin. And in there, he too lays out Hamilton's equation, and particularly how it relates to social insects, which are Wilson's specialty. And in there, he says that Hamilton's ideas are really going to be that which helps us understand the evolution of altruism, not just in social insects, but in virtually everything. And both Dawkins and Ed Wilson write very glowingly of Hamilton's ideas. And then all of a sudden, of course, everybody's paying attention, because these are bestsellers. They're on the front page of the New York Times. They're, at least in Wilson's case, they were very controversial. People knew about the book. And all of a sudden, Hamilton now is getting to be known within the sciences as well as outside the sciences, primarily because of these two guys.
You know, since you're here, people are still confused about exactly what the selfish gene is referring to you. So maybe you could explain that.
Well, I mean, the selfish gene was Dawkins' attempt at a great metaphor for the way that natural selection operates, and the reason he talks about selfish genes is he doesn't think that genes are selfish in the kind of cognitive everyday sense of the word, that they have some desires or needs. He simply was making the argument that any trait that's genetically coded that benefits the individuals that possess that, are that trait is going to increase in frequency if it gives individuals that possess it some kind of advantage over others. And in that sense, genes are selfish in that whatever works, whatever trait they code for, if it works in the sense of making individuals who have it more likely to reproduce than individuals who don't have it, that's going to be favored by natural selection. So selfish is meant in that sense, that whatever works is going to be favored, regardless of whether it's good in the philosophical sense or it's nasty in the philosophical sense, whether we're talking about, you know, cannibalism or altruism. If the ecology of the situation is such that the benefits are greater than the costs, then that trait will spread. And that's what he meant by selfish.
I don't get the sense that people really understand that, sir.
I think that's true. I think, and unfortunately, usually that means they actually haven't read it. And so because, you know, one thing you could say about Richard Dawkins is that, you know, if you read his work, you understand what his, you know, the points he's trying to make. You may disagree with them, but it's very clear what it is that he's trying to do. And so most people, I think, who don't understand that actually have not looked at his book. And of course, he's made this argument now many, many times in any number of follow-up books to The Selfish Gene that are essentially expounding and expanding that argument.
See, this is, you span many, many, many years of study. Are people still studying altruism?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are probably dozens, if not more, labs around the world that are doing work on this today. And interestingly, a lot of it is still where you might expect it. So, you know, there's wonderful work being done on this in primates and birds, where you might expect people to be looking for this. What's interesting is a new development over about the last, I'd say, decade to 15 years, is that there are now these incredible systems where people are looking at the evolution of altruism in microbes, where if you define altruism as being good to another individual at a cost to yourself, then microbes are altruistic in many, many ways. For example, you know, if you look at slime mold, these little tiny things that bop around in the soil, what you see is that they produce these little things called fruiting bodies that where you have a little stalk that pops out of the ground, and on the top of it is a little capsule full of spores that are the next generation of slime mold. But the little ladder that's holding them up are actually slime mold cells as well. And those ladder cells, the ones that are the scaffolding that are holding the capsule with the spores in it, those are slime mold that are never ever going to reproduce. The only thing they're ever going to do is help the spores in the capsule disperse as far as possible. And they're classic altruists. They help others at a cost to themselves. And there are many, many of these examples in microbes now that people are looking at, and experimentally and genetically, in ways that are very, very difficult to do in chimps and white-fronted bee eaters. Although there's great work being done in those systems too, we can look at real-time evolution in these microbial systems, and it's really been eye-opening.
We've touched on the broader implications of this research at the start of the show. Has that changed at all since Darwin?
You know, the people who are doing the work in biology really are, you know, trying to study this the way that they, altruism, they're trying to study that the way they would study any behavioral trait that they were working on. But it's, you know, it is true that there are still many, many sort of philosophical sides to the way that people study this. It's almost impossible to study what, for lack of a better term, we might call goodness without imputing something about what this means for whether or not we're inherently cooperative, humans are inherently cooperative or inherently aggressive. We're neither. Aggression works when aggression works, and cooperation works when cooperation works. It depends on what the ecology and the costs and benefits are. But of course, people, you know, want to grab on to the biology in one way or another to support their view of human nature. I think scientists try whenever possible not to get into the kind of arguments that Huxley and Kropotkin got into, and really just try and answer, okay, you know, here are the costs, here are the benefits, when do we expect to see this, when don't we expect to see this? But you know, we're only human, and if we don't do it, certainly others are taking these ideas that we're developing and using them to, you know, support one view of human nature that they have or another. So in that sense, it's similar to what went on in Darwin's day, but the advances in terms of the experiments and the theory and the underlying genetics are, you know, we're worlds ahead of where we were in Darwin's day.
Lee, as always, wonderful to have you here.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Anytime.
You can find links to Lee Dukotkin and the altruism equation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. I know there's not a lot of time left in the episode, but I really wanted to do a quick interview with Steve Chang. Steve is a neuroscientist at the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at Duke University. He investigates the neuronal basis of social decision-making in monkeys. Late last year, Steve and his colleagues from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, published their research in Nature Neuroscience, showing that monkeys have a specific area in their brains to keep track of altruistic acts. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thank you for being here. So tell us about your research.
So we try to understand how certain parts of the brain are involved in processing rewarding information of another individual. In research from humans, we know certain part of the brain areas are active when you donate your money to charity or when you think about other people or even engage in empathetic concerns. But to know more about how individual neurons process this information, we have to dig deeper. To do that, we use an animal model, in this case, rhesus monkeys, and investigate how different neurons from different parts of their brain encode a process rewarding information of self or another monkey present in the room. And that's the basis of our research. And when we train monkeys to make a series of decisions that can lead to a drop of juice to himself or a drop of juice to the other monkey, we can investigate how the reward that one's received is encoded by different neurons. And the critical condition that we have is in rhesus monkeys are, in general, very selfish. So when you give them an option to deliver, you know, drop of juice to himself or the other monkey, they almost always, you know, choose to deliver juice to himself. And that's not surprising for rhesus monkeys. They're known to be selfish and despotic. But we have this particular condition that the actor monkey is choosing to reward either the other monkey or no one at all. So he's already removed from the rewarding context. In that case, the monkeys actually prefer to deliver juice to the other guy. So we have that unique opportunity to look at the preferred behavior associated with delivering juice to the other monkey. And now, when you record from neurons directly from the brain, we can measure how different individual neurons encode rewarding information of others.
Well, how exactly do you record the activity in individual brain cells?
So this is called extracellular recording. We basically lower a very thin wire down to the region of the brain that we are interested in. And you hear many, many cells there, right? And by discriminating and isolating a certain waveform, we can isolate information, this neuronal activity from a one single neuron.
So then this would be a lot more precise than something like an fMRI.
Right. fMRI is great for knowing generally where the activations are. However, it's really measuring hemodynamic activity, meaning that it's measuring the blood flow, changes in blood flow. So to really know what the neurons are doing, you have to directly measure the activity of a single neuron.
So what's your interpretation of your findings then?
So the area that we found a lot of neurons that care about rewarding information other is called anterior cingulate cortex, and specifically the gyrus portion. There are two parts of anterior cingulate cortex in general. There's the sulcus portion and the gyrus portion. And the gyrus portion is also the area in humans that literally get activated when one donates money to the other person or think about other person's well-being. And in this area, we found neurons that are specifically only encoding information when the other monkey is getting rewarded. So, for example, if you're hearing from this neuron, recording this neuron's activity and watching the activity, if the actor monkey from whom I'm recording neurons from gets the juice, then this neuron might not be active at all. But when the other monkey gets the juice, then this neuron all of a sudden increases activity to reflect change in firing rate. That's one type of neuron we found that are specific to rewarding inflammation of the other monkey, but also in the same area, anterior cingulate gyrus, we also found a neuron that mirrored my own reward and the other person's reward. So this neuron is only active when one receives the juice reward, but also its activity is very similarly modulated when the other person received the juice. But the neurons are pretty quiet when no one received the juice, for example. Huh. So in that case, this neuron could be called reward mirror neuron. So it's mirroring reward of others as if it's my own.
Have these studies been done in any other primates or any studies like this?
No, this is the first study that looked at the reward with respect to whether it's happening to you or happening to the other monkey. Previously, a lot of studies like this has been done in humans, and it's kind of hard study to do in even lower animals like rodents. But rhesus monkey, because of the task I described earlier, we had this unique opportunity to look at this particular dissociation between what kind of rewarding information is happening to me versus what kind of rewarding information is occurring to other individual.
Now, there's been a debate about whether altruism is associated with a general reward system in the brain, or if there is specific circuitry, I guess is the way I would put it, that would be wired to handle it. So does your study tell us anything about that?
When we study monkeys, it's hard to call, you know, this is altruism. Altruism is a very human-centric word.
Right.
So what we interpret this is like building blocks that might lead to more complicated concepts like empathy and altruism. By studying this fundamental, more, say, a little bit lower level than what one might call altruism or empathy, we can start to understand the basic mechanism that could lead to complex concepts in human behavior. So we tested three different regions in the brain, and those all three different regions are reward-related regions, like you just mentioned. First region was orbital frontal cortex. In that region, we found almost all cells only care about self-reward, so only care about the reward that's happening to you. Whereas in the anterior cingulate sulcus, not gyrus, but the sulcus neurons, that also only care about the rewarding information of oneself, but in a way that it only cared about when one does not receive the juice. So it's like, what happened? I didn't get the juice kind of signal. So we call that foregone reward signal. But only the gyrus regions that actually had a lot of neurons that truly encoded the rewarding experience of other. And going back to your question about whether altruism kind of concept is mediated by reward regions, and I absolutely think so. I think a lot of social interaction that we engage in are heavily, heavily reinforcement driven. And because of that, I think it's very important for reward-related regions to process this kind of information as if it's rewarding, so we continue to engage in social behavior. I'm not saying that reward regions are the only regions that are involved in altruism, but I strongly think that altruism kind of behavior are founded upon reward-related circuits.
So this also has a practical application as well, potentially for the study of autism research.
Right, definitely. There has been some evidence that this region, anterior cingulate gyrus, or in humans, it's often called medial prefrontal cortex. A lot of this region has been shown to be a little bit abnormal. Activity is a little bit different than normal in people with autism or people with other neuropsychiatric disorders with social deficits. So it's interesting to see whether the activity in these regions are a little bit off or kind of not quite in balance with respect to the other two areas that I mentioned about caring about self, one's own reward. So when the balance is broken, it might be possible that understanding others and engaging social interaction with respect to others is kind of weakened. And that might be one of the potential reason for not only for autism, but also other neuropsychiatric disorders with social deficits.
Fascinating stuff, sir. Thanks very much for coming by to explain.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And that's it for us. You can find Steve Chang and his work on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, you might like to click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, so that you can stay up to date on show news. Or perhaps to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the podcast, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.